All financial advice provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm speaking to you from the borough of Queens in New York City. It is the 8th day of May, 2023. I also like to remind you I'm the editor of a newsletter called Jay Taylor's Gold, Energy, and Tech Stocks. I believe it's a very exciting time to start thinking about investing in this sector for reasons I think will become clear in today's show, because I'm going to be talking with some people that do exactly that professionally, invest in junior exploration companies. Also like to ask you to send along whatever comments you have about this show. Send them along to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com, questions4taylor@gmail.com. Also, feel free to like this channel. Actually, we'd like you to like this channel, hit the like button at the bottom, and don't forget to subscribe to this channel. I've titled today's show, Picking Bullish Stocks for This Bear Market. Well, in a real bear market, I mean, the kind we saw in 2000, 2008, really finding stocks that go up are very, very difficult. In fact, it's been very difficult in this current market. You know, mostly a few big name macro cap stocks are keeping the indices elevated. We believe that's about to change for reasons I think will also be obvious from today's discussion. But if you want to find good stocks in a really bad market, you got to really think outside of the box. And I don't know of anybody who's more capable of doing that than my three guests today, all from Crescat Capital. Tavi Costa is a portfolio manager. Kevin Smith is a founder and chief investment officer. Both of those gentlemen are with me right now. And Dr. Quentin Henning will join me in the final segment of today's show to reveal a stock that he believes is one of the most undervalued companies in the Crescat portfolio, a company that is in the search for and having a great deal of success in finding gold, silver, and copper. And this company actually has a very major base metal company that has recently invested in it. So it's a story I think you're going to want to hear about. That's in the second segment with Dr. Quentin Henning. But right now, I'm really happy to tell you that Tavi and Kevin are with me. Well, thank you, Tavi and Kevin, for joining me today. It's really great to have you.
Thanks for having us. Looking forward to this.
Yeah, it's Thanks, really Ryan. Great. I really enjoy your weekly, almost every week. I think it's a can't miss thing. If you're in this segment of the exploration companies, I think you really need to pay attention to what you guys are doing there. I should mention that this interview was recorded on May 3rd. So a lot can happen between now and the time this show airs. So keep that in mind as you listen to what Tavi and Kevin have to say. I really would like to talk to Kevin, I'd like to talk to Tavi first about his macroeconomic views. And Tavi, my sense of where you're coming from is that you see a secular trend in rising inflation and interest rates that will go along with that. There has been a massive underinvestment, let's say, in the resource sector, and overinvestment or malinvestment maybe in some other sectors, including technology, and that the markets are about to sort of reward those who recognize the undervaluation in certain markets and probably punish those who are not recognizing the malinvestments of the past. Do I have that more or less right?
Absolutely. Happy to share more about this, but it's Yes, I mean, the secular trends on inflation are one of the major issues we have in current markets, which I think a lot of assets need to be repriced accordingly. Do you mind if I share my screen to share some of our opinions? I
Love
think
to have
we'll
you do that. Love to have you do that.
do that right now. Okay. Hope you guys can see this. Does that work?
Yep.
Yeah.
Perfect. Well, this chart, Jay, is probably one of the most important charts and most relevant ones for investors, in our opinion, but also what encompasses most of our macro views, especially the long-term ones regarding where we sit in terms of valuations for overall equity markets, regarding our views regarding 60/40 portfolios, where we are in terms of gold becoming a larger percentage of portfolios and a defensive asset for most institutions, but also how cheap commodities are relative to equity markets and how cheap tangible assets are relative to financial assets in general. And so this is something we've been trying to replicate at Crescat, looking for short opportunities that we believe are overvalued. Most of those fall in the bucket of long duration assets. And that is given the fact that we've had 30 years or so of more of a secular, I would say, disinflationary environment. We're likely to enter here a multi-year period of inflationary forces is standing higher than historical times. And so this is something that is yet to be reflected in prices of particularly commodities and equity markets. And this ratio is probably going to be at a lot higher levels as well. Something we've been concerned has been this earnings call a 70-year channel, as you can see here, just looking at the basic EPS earnings per share for the S&P 500. And as you can see here, we've been in the 70-year channel. And every time we hit this upper side of this range, we've been in a critical juncture where earnings tend to fall. And today, we certainly have a case to be made that we're likely to see that again. I mean, we have wages and salaries growing, which is part of the inflationary problem, particularly I would say, in lower income folks, part of the economy. The second thing we're seeing as well is the cost of capital being so high. Which we, in our opinion, is a structurally higher cost of capital. It will also be something that will impact prices of particularly equity markets. And also, we've had the situation with deglobalization, which I think is a problem that will intensify the pressure on earnings to contract over time. And material costs, we know we've had a long period of underinvestments. Which you said a chronic period of underinvestments in most of the resource parts industries or natural resource industries, and that certainly will have an impact on margins moving forward. The interesting part of this chart, as you can see here, is the red line, which is diluted EPS, is already starting to diverge here. And we've seen this in the past. It tends to lead the way, and certainly it suggests that we are likely to see another one of those moving forward. There's three buckets of the markets that we feel very confident that need to be repriced, and one of them is mega caps. Mega cap stocks are almost the definition of long duration assets, Jay, and it's mostly because most of the analysts tend to extrapolate their current free cash flow to 20, 30 years from now, and then discount those at a very low rates, which are almost unrealistic given the fact that we believe that the cost of capital itself, which is one significant portion of discount rates, is likely to be much higher moving forward. And if that's the case, everything needs to be reflected into those variables. And here you're looking at FANG stocks trading at very hefty multiples. However, when you look at the growth in the top line side, they've been started to really to decline in real terms. This is an important port side of it because that is the growth side is what justifies most of those really expensive multiples that we have in those markets. If you think about The other sides of what have been causing this bear market rally that we think, and maybe what explains a lot of the macro environment, has to do with interest rates and financial conditions. Mm-hmm. As you can see, the yellow line and the blue line, one shows interest rates, the 10-year yield. The other one shows the yellow line, which is the financial conditions by Goldman Sachs. And you can see both track each other very closely. And it almost perfectly timed the decline in equity markets at the very peak in the end of 2021. And recently, we've had interest rates actually declining a bit on the 10-year, meaning treasuries actually rally, along with financial conditions actually improving a bit. Now, the question investors need to ask themselves is if this is a sustainable move or it's just a counter trend, short-term counter trend from the actual big movement that we are probably starting to see, which is financial conditions being tighter for longer as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that's certainly the case. The 10-year yield is something that is really concerning to us. We think we're probably going to see about $1.2 trillion or so of treasury issuances in the next couple months, really, because of the debt ceiling problem getting resolved, where a lot of people are looking at the default risk. The real risk here is the flood of issuances of treasuries that we will see. And if that's the case, what would that do to the treasury market overall? When we study economics in school, we learn about the risk of interest rates, the risk of default risk in general, but also the risk of inflation. But we never learn about the supply problem. And the supply might be one of the most important factors to be looking at, especially in today's environment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, given that backdrop, would you ever think that we have VIX sub-20, sub-20? No. It seems like equity volatility is incredibly depressed and probably unwarranted and unjustifiable as well. But on the other side of it, you start to see corporate bond yields at levels that we haven't seen. We've only seen during periods of turmoil, like the 2020 recession. That's what you're looking at, the red line. That is the cost of high yield itself, or companies that have low credit ratings. And that's the cost of their debt currently at about average is about 8.5%. If we do see that continuing to be at those higher levels, I think that's going to be problematic for majority of companies. We'll start to see as well bankruptcies emerge and other issues that we haven't seen in a long time. Mm-hmm. Jay, just to close up the view and go back to gold in a minute. Now, back in 2018 or so, Kevin and I were really looking at the yield curve inversion problem. And I was fascinated by looking at yield spreads and seeing how, you know, you get sort of mixed signals in most of them, and decided to really calculate a more comprehensive measurement that it looks at all possible spreads in the yield curve. And so we have about 45 spreads, and you calculate how many of those are getting inverted. Yeah. And this research was important because every time we go above the 70% handle, we have a hard landing. And that is a topic of today's markets, where a lot of people are questioning the risk of a hard landing scenario here. It's important to know that recently we had this threshold being reached back in, I believe it was November of 2021. The highest period that we got actually was about 91%, but that doesn't really help you to manage money. It tells you that a hard landing is likely to occur. How do you really protect your portfolio? One of the best ways to really position your portfolio when you have those problems, and this is by far one of the best macro indicators we use in order to guide us to invest. And clearly what you find is that the gold to S&P 500 ratio tends to perform very well after the fact that you see this trigger of 70% of yield curve inversions in the overall treasury curve. The yellow line is looking at all times in history that we've had that threshold being breached. And that is the performance that you have for the next 2 years. The average performance about 72% of return. The other blue line that you're seeing is just looking at the performance in this 1973-74 and the tech bust, which is very similar to today. And we think that this is, you know, probably one of the best analogs for today's environment, given how commodities are so cheap relative to equities. And by the way, that was the case during the 73-74 stagflationary crisis and the tech bust. And the green line is just showing where we are currently. Mm-hmm. And we're at the very beginning of that move, by the way. Almost done. It's just last chart is how gold has been performing so well and in this environment. We still think that gold is, well, first, it's been purchased by central banks to levels we've never seen since the 70s, I would say, is really a very significant amount of buying from central banks in general. And that is, you know, important because gold is a neutral asset with an incredible history of credibility of serving to improve the quality of international reserves for most central banks and other institutions. And after seeing the treasury market really serving that role of a defensive asset for most 60-40 portfolios and other large institutions, we think gold is going to reemerge as being that asset that will become more prevalent as a defensive part of everyone's portfolios. And no, we don't believe in triple tops. We've never seen a triple top before. So if you look at technically as well, it looks very attractive. We think gold is going to move up significantly higher from here, which brings to question how to really invest in the space. We think it's really by buying gold, but not buying gold physically so much, but really in the ground by investing in high quality exploration and development companies that are still very depressed in valuations while gold is about to make new highs. And by the way, for a fact, gold is the only macro asset in today that is about to make new highs, not Bitcoin. Bitcoin is down over 60% or so from its highs, and not the markets, not even the housing market is at all-time highs today. So there's a lot of interesting setups going on, and certainly buying gold, buying precious metals, and buying commodities relative to the overall markets is probably the most attractive time to do that we've seen in history. So with that, I'll open for questions or maybe pass it on to Kevin.
Yeah, sure. Tavi, if you could take the screen down, that would be great. Yep. I would like to ask you, you know, most people are of the mind that we're going to go into a recession that will take care of inflation, bad inflation. They have bad inflation to them, of course, is commodity inflation. They like to see equity markets inflated. They like to see, the Google and all those stocks go up. They don't, you know, bad inflation is what caused CPI and PPI to rise. You're of a mind, I believe, that this is a secular trend. Why do you think it's different this time? Why do you think this time we're not going to see, the same thing happening again? We have a deflation, and then we go on to another 10, 20 years of marvelous equity market inflation, and everybody's happy.
Well, I think it's important to look back in history and see the other decades that we have similar macro trends unleashing that are currently the case. One of them is the wages and salaries problem, which is not a problem necessarily, but the rise of wages and salaries, just looking at how much corporations have spent on paying their workers over time. We've been at a historical low at that trend, and it's been moving higher recently. Trends with the wage prices spiral tend to be secular at their nature. We've seen that in the 1970s, for instance. And we believe that is not only going to become part of the squeeze of margins, but also going to feel this inflationary period. Number two has to do with the chronic underinvestments in natural resources, mm-hmm. which you can look at the CapEx for energy companies, agricultural companies, metals and mining. And what you're going to find that, especially adjusted for GDP, because $10 million is spent in the ground today, certainly isn't the same of spending $10 million 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And you're going to find clearly that we're at very depressed levels. And the access for capital recently, especially because of the Fed's tightening of monetary conditions and so forth, is only making that even more difficult. The recent pressure, in fact, that we've had in oil prices has been very much aligned, while everyone's focus on the demand side, it's been very much aligned with the fact that the government is again selling strategic petroleum reserves. Mm-hmm. And so you know, we're not really fixing the long-term problem here. We're only delaying something that will probably come back in terms of being upper pressure on commodity prices in general. Number three has to do with the reckless or irresponsible amount of fiscal spending we're seeing. Fiscal spending is at a level that we haven't seen really since the 1940s. And I think this is, even in the 70s, I would say most of politicians were pretty much aware that government spending creates inflation. Today, I'm not sure that's really the case. While 50% of the fiscal spending accounts for the debt side of it, of paying their debt, the interest payment, the other 50% accounts for inequality issues. It accounts for the Green Revolution. It accounts for this revitalization of the manufacturing plants in developed economies. This is, are all filling this, those issues with irresponsible fiscal spending. And number four has to do with deglobalization. We've lived in a very globalized environment over the last 15, 20 years. I don't think will be the case given what's being triggered recently with the issues between US and China, Russia and Ukraine, Middle East and other parts of the economy, of the global economy. I think we're seeing big changes in terms of geopolitics, and that's going to play a big role into filling, again, this inflationary forces. And so those are the big reasons why we think inflation will be structural, not cyclical this time around.
And so do you see then the Federal Reserve not really having control of interest rates? That is, if you have this inflation going on, obviously savers are going to require higher returns. So do you see this as something that's beyond the Federal Reserve's control? Because I think most people think, oh, the Federal Reserve, we can always depend on them. They're going to save us again.
I think ultimately rates are going to have to be higher for longer, however, not too high. And so the Fed's job is not so much to fight inflation or unemployment rates or labor markets. It's really to try to sustain the stability of the financial system. And that means if rates go too high, they're going to have to manipulate rates lower. What does that mean? QE again, or some sort of bond purchases that manipulates rates lower. That is just financial repression in a secular inflationary environment, which is a very, very positive environment, almost explosive environment for commodities and tangible assets. And so it's hard to believe that the Fed is not trapped in this environment. It is very, very much trapped. And so, you know, this is setting the stage for investors that are looking for inefficiencies in those tangible assets realm. Some folks are more focused on agricultural, others in energy. We think that metals and mining certainly is part of our niche, working with Quinton Henny. And I think that level of inefficiencies, in especially in exploration and development part of the industry, are something we haven't seen in a very long time. I don't remember seeing a time when gold prices are about to hit new levels and this part of the industry remains so depressed. And so to me is a major opportunity.
Yeah. Well, certainly, you know, for generations or for decades, we were able in the United States to live beyond our means because foreign capital would flow our way. The net export countries, China primarily, but Japan as well, other countries, Saudi Arabia, which has now turned somewhat hostile towards the United States. These are sources of treasury buyers that simply aren't there now. So it seems to me, Toby, what you're saying is, they can't really, the Fed was going to have to intervene and start pumping money into the system to keep the rates from going to where they really have to go to clear the market otherwise, right? So there's no there's no way out for the Fed. They're going to have to print. Jay Powell seems to be tough. He seems to really want to do the right thing. But I think what I hear you saying is you don't think that that's possible.
Yes, and just to leave you with a final thought, I mean, well, you know, we've had five decades of negative performances in equity markets. Those 5 decades happened for two reasons solely, inflation and high valuations. We've never had those two happen at the same time. And that's certainly the case today at a time when most analysts are extrapolating the earnings you know, prospects of most of those companies, especially in the mega cap space. And if you are in an inflationary environment, pressures, you're likely to see a lot of pressure on margins to be squeezed by a lot of the things I mentioned here. And the same would happen with growth in real terms. And the same will happen with readjusting for discount rates. And I don't think the markets have really done any of that yet. So a lot of things will have to change. 60-40 portfolios are probably not going to be anywhere close to as popular as how they are currently. I think we're going to see a place where portfolios will be much more balanced with a lot of commodities, of large allocation towards gold, and bonds and equities will still serve a role into portfolios too. But sure, things have to change.
Yeah. Well, they'll have to change for sure. And Kevin, I'd like to go to you now. That you talked about the trifecta of macro imbalances. Could you explain to our listeners, to our viewers, what you're talking about there?
Sure, Jay. Thanks for having us on. Really, there's and this was Tavi's coining of the trifecta of macro imbalances. And the way that I see it, we have both an overvaluation of long duration financial assets, as well as record leverage would be the second one, that's creating this insolvency problem that we're starting to see in the banks with the Fed having raised rates. And the third is really inflation that's structural. It's embedded due to a decade now of underinvestment in commodities and natural resources, and this energy transition that we now have, and all the pillars of inflation that Tavi was talking about that are structural. It's not just the commodity underinvestment, but that's a big one. And it's an unholy trinity of problems that truly has the Fed trapped today.
And so do you see, you talk about the great rotation from the tech stock, from the tech sector, other sectors where there's been enormous amounts of malinvestment, I would argue because of, low interest rates that have been manipulated, that clearly haven't allowed the markets to work. So you have a misallocation of resources away from things that people actually really have to have. And of course, there's also this deglobalization that is causing a shortage that is really now making it very important that the United States and other countries start to find their own minerals, their own resources. And so is it market forces are just going to cause this great rotation to happen, Kevin?
I really believe it is destined. There's no guarantees, of course, but the setup is phenomenal. Tavi showed the commodity to equity ratio chart. That's a nice illustration of it. Can I share my screen? This is just looking at the mega cap tech stocks, the top 10 mega caps, and this is one of my favorite charts because it really illustrates how just one of the bubbles today is the mega cap tech stocks. It's not the only bubble, but it's one of them. And if you compare it to the tech bubble back in 2000, it's even bigger. It's a bigger tech bubble. When you look at these top 10 stocks relative to GDP, these companies are just too big in valuation. We're looking at enterprise value relative to GDP, and they at the peak of the tech bubble, it got up to about 30% of GDP. Recently, at the beginning of last year, we were up to 56% enterprise value to GDP. And when you get so big relative to the economy, you just can't grow any longer. These stocks are cyclical stocks too. They're not just growth stocks, especially when you get to be such a big part of the overall economy. And now we're starting to see the earnings, the free cash flow, especially, all turn negative in aggregate for these companies. And the top line growth has slowed substantially. The earnings growth is turning negative already in some cases year over year. These are cyclical stocks, and they're still trading at valuations that are higher than the tech bubble. We notice also how the composition changes. Were the top 10 stocks back in 2000, only one of them is in the top 10 today, Microsoft. Companies like Tesla and Google and Meta, which is Facebook, didn't even emerge until after the tech bust. So we don't know what the top companies, the top tech companies are going to be 10 or 20 years from now. Mm-hmm. And the valuations are just, it's excessive. So this is one of the areas that is extremely vulnerable right mm-hmm. now. Mm-hmm. Dominates the S&P, of course. Just one example of where some of the downside we think it is going to come from.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, let me ask you, do you think that the ETFs and the sort of passive investing, more so now that, you know, huge amounts of money flow into these ETFs and they have to buy these large macro cap stocks, that's playing a role in keeping these stocks overvalued? Because the metrics that you're showing us aren't, you know, aren't hidden from anybody. It's obviously, you know, they're deteriorating. They're not certainly the kind of gains, the kind of growth that you expect for the multiples that are being paid, as Tavi pointed out. How do you account for the fact that the market isn't recognizing this yet?
That's a huge part of it, Jay, is the index investing phenomenon that we've had, the ETFs. These companies dominate the indices, they dominate the ETFs. And investors have been trained that to buy the dip, to buy and hold. And that you can't beat the market. That's what they've been trained. I mean, even some business schools try to teach that the markets are efficient, mm-hmm. and that's what has been drilled into investors' minds over this entire bear market, and so over this entire long bull market period. We think we're now in a bear market, and what's going on? These people are doing whatever they can to stay in it or to buy the dip. Mm-hmm. And that's, I mean, I remember, you probably remember too, during the tech bubble and tech bust. I mean, remember everyone kept buying the dip there, or hanging on, you know, it's going to turn around. I'm not selling my Cisco or my Sun Microsystems or my Intel. And, but it just kept grinding down and down. And I think, you know, this is just a bear market rally in our view. And, yeah. And we have another, you know, 2001 type thing. I mean, so active management, value investing, you know, these things have been thrown out the window mm-hmm. in this whole long bull market period. I think it's going to be coming back in a big way. Macro investing, value investing, market timing, it, you know, there is alpha, there is outperformance to be had by active management and macroeconomic timing and value investing.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, you talked about a slide you showed in your last Crestcat gets active the first Friday of this month. $215 million in micro cap gold, silver exploration stocks. Could you talk a little bit about that portfolio?
Sure. Here's just a little bit of a snapshot on some of those stats on our portfolio that we have at Crestcat. We have been focused on the metals and mining industry, and predominantly precious metals. We're predominantly focused on the exploration companies, because that's where we think the biggest value opportunity is, the most appreciation potential in this market. And we currently have about $220 million invested across our firm in these small cap mining stocks. And some of them are micro caps, but they are companies that are in control of the big new discoveries of metal out there, with the need for inflation protection, with gold likely to break out here, with the energy transition and all of the thirst and hunger for metals that it requires for renewable energy, for the electric grid, for batteries. We think that we are going to be in an extraordinary metals bull market because of the undersupply, and relative to the valuations today, we think metals prices are getting ready to take off. And so, but where's the part of the market that's been forgotten? It's the exploration segment. And this chart shows it pretty well too. We're just looking at the TSX Venture Index overall, which is where most of the exploration focused mining companies are listed. And this index is literally dominated by exploration metals mining companies. Probably 80% of the companies that are listed here are exploration companies. And look how depressed it is relative to gold itself. In the yellow line, you see gold about to break out to new all-time highs. And just for this index to get back to where it was, you know, 13 years ago, is a 286% return opportunity.
Right.
But in a real bull market for gold, these types of companies, especially if you have the right ones, can be up, you know, 3, 4, 5 times higher than the price of the metal itself. So these are the types of companies we're focused on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's why we have, you know, among this portfolio that's only valued at $200 million today,
we have
new and incipient discoveries, bona fide discoveries and incipient discoveries that are in the making with a probability adjusted, you know, gold and the gold equivalent, because some of them are silver and we got some copper and nickel stories too. But 286 million gold equivalent probability adjusted target ounces that we believe will be delivered. And this is more gold that gold equivalent than the Fed owns on behalf of the US Treasury, the largest entity that owns gold on the planet. And you know, can we promise that we're going to be able to deliver this? No, not we can't. It's a target, but we have a geologic expert, Quentin Henney, who is one of the preeminent exploration geologists on the planet, who's helped us build this portfolio, and he's come up with these targets. And so this is how we model it, because in a normal bull market environment for precious metals and for mining stocks, the exploration companies will trade up to about 20 cents on the dollar relative to the metal value in the ground that deposit ultimately proves to be. And there's empirical data to support this, but where is the market today, you know, being so depressed as we showed you here, and with the money flows being so, having come down for 2 years, is looking at dollar trading volume. The valuations are so depressed right now. Look at how this is cyclical, how the flows, they go down, they go up, they go down, they go up, they go down. We think we have another major inflow cycle coming. You've already seen it in the price of gold, in the price of the larger cap producing companies and the mid cap producing companies, but the junior explorers, the ones that control the new metals that the world needs, they're still depressed, but it's starting to turn. You can start to see these money flows turning down here, and that's important. But what does it mean for where the portfolio is valued today relative to what it's worth, what it's potentially worth? And that 20% Lassonde curve model that we have, it's a modified Lassonde curve model, and we have our own estimates and Quentin's estimates that we use, to including future dilution, because these companies will need to raise more capital. But if these companies were to trade up to 20% of our probability adjusted, dilution adjusted targets,
mm-hmm.
This number is insane. I mean, it's a 3,800% appreciation potential. Now, I'm not saying that our portfolio is going to be up 38%, but this is how we model it. This is a margin of what we consider like a margin of safety in a Benjamin Graham, Warren Buffett kind of a way. What's it potentially worth? And this is at the current, this is using the current spot gold price and the current silver prices. And these targets will go even higher if we get into a real bull market for gold and silver, which we do envision. But is this a model where our companies could, you know, deliver overall, our portfolio could deliver a 2, 3, 4, 5 fold type of return? I believe it is. And And this is how we look at things.
Yeah. Well, indeed, Kevin, you and I, at least, if not Tavi, have been around to see another great bull market in gold stocks in the 1970s, 1980. And, you know, I've seen it happen before. And I think the upside is much greater now. Of course, we have to remind ourselves that it's not that gold is going up in value as much as it's the currencies are being destroyed through monetization of everything. But nonetheless, that's the way you you build wealth and you retain wealth through gold and silver. And the companies that can find the gold in the ground and do it with a profit, of course, those are going to be the huge winners of the future. I have no doubt about that as well. I couldn't help but notice your triple bottom there, Kevin, with the TSX Venture Exchange, I think it was. And then thinking of Tavi's triple top for gold, you know, it seems like maybe, you know, maybe we're ready to click. And I, the other thing was the triple top, Tavi says he's never seen them before. I think I have seen a few before. And if you break through that triple top, you're probably off to something really big. And I would also just note that I chart daily London PM fixed gold prices. And in April, the average price for April was the highest it's ever been, the first time over $2,000 an ounce. So I really think we're likely onto something very significant. And you guys are one of the few investment firms that are out there aggressively recognizing this and investing in exploration companies. I have no doubt that that's why the market capitalization of these companies have not gone, you know, are really not where you think they should be. And because I don't think most people have really woken up to the fact, to your investment thesis yet. I would guess that the main reason is because investors generally are just not focused on this sector. They're continuing to believe what has happened, what's worked the last decade or so will continue to work. That's the way most people think. But anyway, those are my views. Maybe a last thought from either of you that you might have about just summing up. And maybe Tavi, start with you.
Well, this is an interesting setup that we have, not only because of where we think gold prices are moving towards, but also of something we talk a lot about internally, which is the lack of vision of most of the gold companies, the leading businesses of this industry. And the lack of vision is really due to also no investments in or focus on production growth or expansion of their resources. Instead, those companies are doing more buybacks and dividends than CapEx. In other words, they're returning more capital to shareholders than investing in their own companies. And is creating a scenario where some other businesses can become the next Newmonts and Barricks of the cycle. And you know, we're certainly trying to work hard here to create value to our investors. And ultimately, our goal is to invest in the best businesses we can find. But it's really incredible how the majors are just not doing what they're supposed to do in such a depressed market. Mm-hmm. And so creating a great setup for other businesses to be creative. And so Crescat is definitely chasing to be a large investor of this gold cycle. We want to be aggressive. We want to take advantage of what we think are truly historical prices that we're entering as investors. And we can really unlock value through Quentin's expertise. I think this is probably one of the best opportunities I've seen in my career.
Yeah, I would agree. Kevin, maybe you could just sum up as well and tell our viewers where they can go to learn more about Crescat. Of course, there's your weekly videos that are just, I think, a must for anybody that's in this sector. But just tell people where they can go to learn more about the various funds that you have.
Sounds great, Jake. So in summing up, I think the opportunity today is just absolutely incredible on the commodity long side of the market, on the precious metal side, but especially for this activist investing approach that we have with Quentin Henny to really build a portfolio of the companies that are discovering and finding the the metal deposits that will be the next big mines of the future, and we have a need for it. So the value, the appreciation potential is on this, what we call the left-hand side of the Lassonde curve, is extraordinary. And this left-hand side, which is the exploration side of the Lassonde curve, is where the billionaires make their billions in this industry, whether it's Pierre Lassonde, Robert Friedland, Tom Kaplan, Ross Beatty, Eric Sprott. It's this side of the market where you can not just hedge against inflation, but truly create wealth. Mm-hmm. And so this is our largest long side of the portfolio today. Where you can go to learn more about this, people should really check out our website at crestcap.net. We have just an incredible amount of information on there. The letters that Tavi and I write, the videos that we do every Friday, you can find them on there under the activist positioning tab. And you can go through and find all of Quentin's geologic talks on all of the companies and all the public companies in our portfolio. And it's a wealth of information. Merrick is our client service and associate who can field phone calls and emails and answer any questions anybody has if they want to learn more about Crestcat's strategies. And you can find all that information on our website.
Yeah, and Kevin, I believe in one of your presentations recently, you noted that you're invested in about 70 different junior exploration companies in your fund. And I think I have that right?
That's something around there.
Huge number, and the drills are turning, and I don't remember how many drills, a huge number of drills. It's a very active, it is Crestcat gets active. You guys are owning 10 to 15% of many of the companies you invest in, and you do have. And quite frankly, most of these companies respect Quentin Henning to such an extent that they take his insights are welcomed. And so you guys have some input, I believe, into a lot of the decisions that are made as well, which is also comforting to me, knowing Quentin and his capabilities. So I want to thank both of you for being with me. And I just want to tell our viewers not to go away, because Dr. Quentin Henning is coming up right away. He's gonna share a top pick of his. Actually, it's one of the companies that Crestcat owns. It's a company that is it's really having a lot of success in discovering some gold and silver and copper. Very exciting story, but hardly anybody knows about it. You might want to pay attention. So don't go away and hear what Quentin has to say. He'll tell you the name of that company and explain why he likes it so much. Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. Well, you just heard Tavi Costa and Kevin Smith of Crestcat Capital explain why they are extremely bullish on small cap junior exploration stocks, especially companies that are in the hunt for major world-class gold and silver discoveries. And there's quite a few of them in Crestcat's portfolio that are looking very, very good and very promising. Really happy though to have Dr. Quentin Henning, who is of course part of that Crestcat management team, with me to tell me about one that he thinks might be especially undervalued compared to some of the others in the portfolio that Crestcat holds. Thank you for joining me, Quentin.
Jay, always a pleasure.
It's really good to have you with us, and especially to spring a surprise on us. Let's cut to the chase. What is this mystery stock, the one that you think might be one of the more undervalued amongst many undervalued stocks in the Crestcat Cap portfolio? Sure.
Look, you know, we at Crestcat like to invest in exploration stage companies. Okay, we tend to focus on companies that have a good project, first of all, but also operating in a good jurisdiction. I like to see stories in areas that we know we can build mines, okay? And usually you can tell right away if the project is near existing operational mines, that's a good sign. And this one is certainly one of those. Now, sometimes companies are early stage. In other words, they come to us even pre-IPO. We've invested in a number of IPO stage and taken them through to public listing and stuff. But we also see some companies that have been in exploration for a while, even a few years, who have a good product and a good team, but just needed to do some work. And you could tell they were on the cusp of making a discovery, but not quite there yet. And one of the stories that we invested in about a little over a year ago, is Brixton Metals. Okay, so we're talking about a company, it's been around a while, I think 10 years or so even, but they have one of the most astounding, we'll call it exploration projects, largest and very highly prolific exploration projects in BC. It's way up in the northwestern part of BC. It's actually north of the Golden Triangle, but it's in, we'll call it similar well-endowed terrain as the Golden Triangle. All right. So we're going to talk about Brixton today.
All right. Brixton. And I guess there are about three, there's a lot of shares there, Quentin. That's one of the things that caught my attention, 381 million shares. But of course, you've got to put that in the context of what they have or what they might have. And so I don't know, the 13 cents, something around that range, I saw it recently in US money.
Yes.
Giving it a market cap of a pretty minuscule market cap. And they have some money too, I think around $16 million or so.
Well, they do have money, and that money came in from a placement from BHP last August or September. And we were, prior to that, the biggest shareholder in the company. We actually bought share. We did a small placement with them in late 2021, I think. But we actually bought a lot of shares in the market over time as well. As they demonstrated, their projects looked like they were advancing quite well. But seeing BHP come in, that's every company's dream. They do have lots of money to go out and do a robust drill program this season. All right. And that's what we're into. We like to see these drill stage companies. All right. Yes, they have a lot of shares, Jay. You know how it works in the mining industry.
Yeah.
Companies every year, they have to fund their project. And if you look at Brixton, they made it through some of the worst years in the history of the mining industry, mm-hmm. 2013, 14, 15, 16. We all remember it. Okay.
Right.
Keep things alive, keep things going during that time. They needed to raise money, and that's why they're in a position they are today. But it doesn't, the share count does not reflect necessarily the underlying asset value and its potential. All right. So it's trading at 13 cents, pretty puny market cap, a little over 40 million US market cap. But this is a company that has a lot of value.
Yeah, and I mean, I believe they're funded for this year's work program too. So it doesn't mean they have to go out and raise money at 13 cents US now, right?
Yes, that's correct. They broke the pattern that they had been in, where they would go out and do work, come back, announce results, stock would go up, and then boom, it'd fall down during the lean months, the low news flow months in February, March, and April. It's come off a little bit, but not like it did previously. It didn't go down to a nickel or a dime or something, and they were groveling around looking for enough money to go drill again. They have plenty of money to drill again. And that's why I want to talk about them, is because they have a huge treasury, and they're about ready to embark on a pretty robust project on a drill program on two, I'll call it incipient discoveries. They're clear discoveries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Thorn project, that's their flagship project, I believe, right? And it's a large scale project. I mean, there's tons of different targets, but there's two in particular, I think a copper gold porphyry, and then a gold target as well, right?
That's right. And, I think the best way to show it would be to just share screen, if that's okay. All right.
With Absolutely.
Okay, let's do that. All right, look, I went straight to their corporate presentation here. This is the corporate deck. Anybody can access it on the internet. All right. I'm going to go forward and show, first of all, share structure, share position. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
181 million shares out. You can see BHP took a 19.9% stake last year by putting in quite a bit of cash. This is every company's dream to have a big backer like this. Really says that they are onto something that is of significance, that caught the attention of, the world's biggest mining company. Okay, this is huge. We are slightly behind BHP, but we've actually got close to 20% ourselves. We have a little bit of room there, but I think we're pretty darn close to 20% at the moment.
Yeah, well, you were there, Quentin, you were there first, and BH came in after you.
That's correct. We got in starting in late 2021 and then bought a lot of shares in early part of 2022. And then BHP came in I believe it was August or September. Mm-hmm. That's right. Yep. All right. Now I'm going to go down to show the property, first of all. So a lot of people are familiar with the Golden Triangle. This is a map showing claim holdings in northwestern BC. The Golden Triangle is really down in the area to the south here. I mean, this right here, Red Mountain, Bruce Jack, you can see KSM and so forth, SK Creek. This area down in here is more traditionally thought of as a Golden Triangle. Mm-hmm. So we're actually north of that. Okay, we're up here at Brixton is a Thorn project. It's north of the Golden Triangle, but it's still in these prolific, well-endowed geologic, environments that we see. A little bit younger, the intrusions here are probably Cretaceous in age. What does it mean to the average retail investor? Not much. I mean, it's still a big, big elephant mm-hmm. country, looking for big deposits here. All right, so we're going to go to this Thorn project and talk about a couple of their assets. Now, one of them happens to be copper. Focus, that's the Camp Creek. You can see here the property scale map with all their surface sampling to date. It's got rock chip samples, soil samples, and so forth. But this project right here, Camp Creek, this guy right here, that's the one where they've drilled and they look like they're onto a major porphyry copper discovery. I'll talk more about that in a minute. Mm-hmm. Now, they have lots of other targets here. In fact, I would dare say that they'll probably test a few more of these. Like late last year, they put out some news about the Metla area, this area down here right in the center of the land holding. And that one produced some astounding results of copper, very high-grade copper, and even some high gold numbers in there as well. I wouldn't be surprised to see them drill a little bit down here as a first test as well. And then you have the Trapper target. Now, Trapper shows copper anomalism. This is immediately south of Camp Creek. But it is more of a gold project, and that's why I want to show the next slide. This image here shows gold values, so similar presentation of data. We have rock chip samples, soil samples, and silt samples, just like the previous map. But this time you can see the gold values. Yeah. And Trapper target in particular is mainly a gold system. It's interesting you have this copper system and then a gold system right next to it. Mm-hmm. But that seems to be the way this particular area works out. Now, whether they're tied together, I would argue probably not. Okay, this porphyry at Camp Creek appears to be its own system, whereas the Trapper target I'll talk about in a second appears to be something different. But this Camp Creek project it's taken a few years for them to make what I call the bona fide discovery. They drilled the shallow areas here over a period of maybe 10 years. I think some of the holes in this region, the first holes, go back to the 2000, I think 12-13 period. But it wasn't until they drilled a deeper hole, and I'll show you in cross section that mm-hmm. hole, that they made what I'll call the real discovery. Okay, so this is a plan view. Mostly presented as copper equivalent. The copper is the predominant metal driving value here. All right. Mm-hmm. But here's the history. Okay, so look up at the top. You see just zillions and gazillions of little tiny shallow holes. And these were the ones that were drilled early days. In fact, most of them, they haven't even bothered to put the assays in because, they were simply hitting the anomalous top of a system at depth. But in 2019, they did drill a hole down right here, this hole 19150, that did see a long continuous interval of breccias and stuff. We'll call it leakage coming off of something bigger.
Yeah.
Okay, now doing some, creative geology and thinking, they then came in and they put in holes over in this area. In fact, in 2021, they had an 21 meter intercept of nearly 0.5% copper, but it included, look at this, 318 meters of 0.92% copper equivalent. I would call that the discovery hole. That's the bona fide discovery. That was made roughly 10 years after the company got established. Okay. Yeah. This is how long it takes sometimes to make a discovery like this. Now, you can see right away there is a high-grade porphyry system taking shape at depth here. Mm-hmm. And in this image, we're actually looking southeast, all right? I have spun this model around umpteen times. I can't tell you how many times I look at it as data has come back. And I do think that much like many porphyries in BC, that there is probably a east-northeast grain to the porphyry. In other words, mm-hmm. porphyries here aren't necessarily perfectly cylindrical. Like, you know, we all see in our head that these things are kind of upright cylinders with a kind of a carapace, a cap of mineralization. In this case, I think the system is actually squeezed and rotated slightly. Uh-huh. Okay. And I think it actually trends to the east northeast. Uh-huh. Right. And what I've understood from talking with the company is that they're going to follow up on these exciting drill holes down here, but by drilling it more along that trend this year. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I expect this year to be the year where we actually see them start to define probably some higher grade, but also define the ultimate footprint of this porphyry system. Now look at the scale down at the bottom. This is a kilometer bar down here at mm-hmm. the bottom. Okay. Just to put it, plant in everybody's head, a kilometer by a kilometer by a kilometer cube is a billion cubic meters of rock. At a density of 2.7 tons per cubic meter. Mm-hmm. 1 cubic kilometer hosts about 2.7 billion tons.
Right.
Yeah. All right. Now, you know, is this going to be exactly a cubic kilometer? No, but I think it could be a half a cubic kilometer in size.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so what does that mean? Well, it could mean you know, this deposit, this discovery turns into, say, a 1.3 billion ton, pretty decent grade. We'll call it 0.6-0.7% copper equivalent deposit.
Mm-hmm.
Question comes, can you mine that underground? Can you? Well, yes. If you look nearby, there's a deposit to the east of this region called Red Chris. It's, you know, I think it's in that previous map. I'll go back up here for just a jiffy. All right. So here we are up at Brixton's up in the north, the upper left, but over here in the green, you can see Red Chris. Red Chris is a large porphyry copper gold system, belongs to Newcrest, soon to be Newmont. And yes, they're mining. They're now moving to mining the deeper part of that system as a block cave. I think you can do the same thing here. And I'm absolutely certain that BHP sees that kind of potential as well. Mm-hmm. All right. So this is one major, major discovery that could be, we'll call it a big company kind of project.
Right.
I think it's very, very desirable for a company like BHP.
Right. Well, BHP certainly wouldn't be fooling around with something unless they thought it had prospects of being massive, really.
Exactly. Okay. There's a mine in Chile called El Teniente. This reminds me a lot of that. And the grades are slightly lower, but not too far off. Okay. And El Teniente has been an absolute monster. This thing could prove to be a lot bigger. If this thing is kind of squeezed, like I said, they could end up chasing this thing over maybe a couple kilometer strike. In other words, it could be a, you know, two or three billion ton deposit. I don't know. But I do think it smells and looks like a major discovery. BHP certainly does as well.
Mm-hmm. All right. That's the copper story.
All right.
But I believe, Quentin, they see a tremendous, I mean, not just in that particular location, but I know I'm talking to Gary Thompson last week that their BHP has their eyes on some other areas to the northwest, I believe, of where this discovery is. Is maybe part of the same system even?
Gigantic. Yes, the BHP is contributing a lot of brain power, we'll call it, to the team's efforts here. And yes, I do know that BHP has other targets. I didn't realize that Gary, that they've talked about those before. I haven't gotten fully up to date on these myself, but I do know that they're looking at either extensions or additional systems here. It's clear from the property. I mean, look, let's go back to the copper. Look, there's no way that one porphyry system located right here generated all of this copper anomalies. There's just no way. Okay, there's a lot more going on here, and I'm sure that BHP looked at this. What does a major mining company want? They want a big land position. Okay, why? Because if they're going to come into a country like this, they don't want just a one-off. You know, like yes, this is big, but they want a district. Yeah, this is a district scale land package.
Right.
So yes, I'm sure that BHP is going to point them to further targets, maybe further areas they should test.
Yeah.
All right. So with that in place, you want me to talk about the Trapper?
Yeah, please do. I the Trapper is very exciting as well.
Okay. So, you know, this project is to the south or southeast of Camp Creek. And geochemically, it actually looks like there is a link between these, which is really, really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But the system at Trapper is, by and large, it is exclusively gold mineralization. And to me, looking at the rocks they've drilled to date, it looks like what I call an alkaline gold system. It looks like the gold system is related to alkaline magmas. Yet you see it as one cohesive. Look at all this chemistry here. Look at all the sampling. You know, it would be very unusual to say, you know, this is not connected to the rest of this. Maybe it is. Maybe it is. I don't know. But it is distinctly different than what you see at Camp Creek.
Mm-hmm.
Right? But it is a major discovery on its own. Now, they've really only drill tested a very, very small part of this system. And that's what people must understand. If you look at the scale, like if I go back here, that's 11 kilometers. Okay, and these guys have really just tested a wee small part of the Trapper target right here in the middle. What have they found to date? They've got some exceptional drill hits. Now, these drill holes happen to have both gold, high grade gold, and longer intervals of lower grade gold. Okay, the high grade gold catches my attention right away because when I see numbers like this, like these numbers that you see in the blue boxes, these values are very high. And with respect to gold deposits, you often see numbers like this in alkaline gold systems, especially when the rock looks like this right here. Okay, this is a picture of core from some of the drilling that they did recently. And you can see it's controlled by a small fracture here. This is, you know, that's a pointer, like a pencil pointer. Uh-huh. All right. This is a very small fracture, maybe a millimeter or two wide, and it hosts abundant coarse gold. Where else have we seen this? Tuvatu in Lion One.
I was going to say.
Exactly. It looks exactly like what you'd see at Tuvatu. So that's why my brain tends to jump in that direction. Now, in spite of that, they also have these huge intervals. Like, look here on this page, 253 meters of 1.4 grams.
Yeah.
398 at 0.95. You got 139 at 2.14, 304 at 1.19. Okay, so there's definitely a large cloud of lower grade gold that encompasses this high grade stuff. What might this lead to? I think this is a major alkaline gold system. And this, when you put everything collectively together, it reminds me of certain places around the world where you have this unusual juxtaposition of different types of world-class deposits, like copper, you know, Camp Creek, and here we have gold. And an example of that would be New Guinea, okay? In New Guinea, you have, you know, world-class copper deposits, you know, think Grasberg and things like this. But you also have world-class alkaline gold deposits like, you know, Porgera and stuff like this. So I think these guys have a unique piece of real estate here that has the potential to host, you know, exceptional world-class deposits of both metals. And look at the size they've drilled. Jay, this is crazy. Like this from there to there is maybe, look at the scale bar down, is maybe 400 meters long strike to date. The anomaly is 11 kilometers. Okay, they have lots of room to grow here. This is a huge, huge system.
So, Quentin, I understand if it's an alkaline system, it's nothing like Snowline's intrusive system, but certainly the numbers that we're looking at, these long intersections, 253 meters, 1.4, reminds me a lot of the kind of numbers we're seeing at Snowline's.
It does. You know, Kevin Smith makes fun of me all the time because I talk about, you know, deposits being related to magnetism. Well, a lot of deposits are, okay. And he says, so this is really just a snow line, right? And I'm like, well, I mean, it kind of is, but it's different in some ways too. Like snow line, it's the difference is the depth that they form. In the case of snow line probably formed down deep, quite deep, maybe 5-10 kilometers deep, in the magma chamber, in the actual source, you know, melt that used to be down in the crust.
Mm-hmm.
That's the environment for snow line. This system formed way up towards the top in what we call the, you know, the epizonal or epicrustal part of the system, very shallow depth, in the volcanic regime. All right. So are they really that different? Well, probably not. This is probably just a high level version of a snow line. Think of it that way.
So the higher grade stuff closer to the surface than the snow line, but snow line has what looks like an economic deposit as well, but,
Oh, very much so. Yes, easily. So geologic, all I'm talking about is geology.
Yeah.
Is simply a matter of depth, in my view. Like between these two systems, these are very similar, but this one formed at a shallower depth.
Very exciting. Got high grade and these long drill intercepts as well of lower grade. Right. So.
Yeah. So look, they have lots of drilling coming this year, you know, with $16 million in the bank. And the team they've got a very good, strong technical team. I'm sure they'll be a very aggressive. They talk about drilling these two targets, Strapper and Camp Creek, you know, and trying to expand these, but also, you know, like seeing if Camp Creek can't grow into like doing some big step outs, see if it can't grow into the multi-billion ton kind of category. But don't forget, they have all the rest of these targets. Okay, if we go back here, let's go to the copper one. Again, Metla generated some just astounding numbers last year.
Yeah,
I wouldn't be surprised to see them drill a hole or two here and maybe some of these other targets they have. They have scads of targets across their property.
Yeah, because, I mean, you're looking at 1%. Those darker squares, green squares, are 1%. These are really high grades, high values for surface, so.
Yes, they are.
Yeah. Very interesting. Very interesting indeed. Well, you know, getting back to the Trapper, Quentin, I saw a cross section of the drills that were put in. It looked to me like the geology or the geometry would be really favorable towards a low, just thinking ahead towards potentially towards a low stripping ratio for an open pit. I don't know if you've thought about it or not. I'm sure you have.
You know, you're correct. The dip is favorable with the topography in that area. You know, whether that kind of profile persists as they go along strike for the kilometers that they have, you know, that might change from place to place. But right where they drilled thus far, it looks like it's a very favorable geometry.
Well, those are that's the focus of the company, the Thorn, those two particular targets right now. But the company has also some other projects that it's monetizing. It's got Hog Heaven.
Yes.
I think it's got a deal with somebody. I think maybe Robert Friedland's involved with that.
Correct. Ivanhoe. That's in Montana.
Uh-huh.
It's, you know, a high level, we'll call it porphyry, high sulfidation type environment. So, you know, it's got copper gold potential, but it's a much higher level system. And yes, Friedland Ivanhoe is earning in on that, I believe.
Yeah. Yeah, so they're monetizing that. I think they're getting $4.5 million or something like that to help, you know. But as I understand it, the earning company has to spend something like $40 million on exploration. And I guess Brixton could be left with a 25% interest if the company continues to move, if the earn-in continues to progress.
Yes, that's correct. They would retain a residual 25% interest, and that's not a bad thing. You know, it's always good to have a big company come in and spend money on a project like that when you've already got a pretty big project in your portfolio at Thorn. You know, you don't want to have too many mouths to feed, especially in the market. It's tough to raise money.
Right, exactly. And Atlin Goldfields project, another one that they're monetizing. So these are little, you know, these are positives, I think, as well. But obviously, as you say, you've got to keep focused on the main flagship project. Well, is there anything else and what we should be watching for? I guess when do you think they'll start drilling?
Look, the country up there, I would say by mid-June, late June, they should be able to get drills in. I'm sure they're already doing prep work up there. Usually crews move in late May, early June, and start their work. And then by late June, almost all of the companies in the general region are drilling, and they can persist drilling until, you know, the snow stays at bay, you know, into mid-October. So I think we should see a good, you know, a 4-month period out of these guys.
Good. Excellent. Well, I guess we just watch for drill results as the company gets through the summer drilling season. And that's what shareholders should be focused on. But it seems to me that this is one that, well, I think the sector in general just doesn't get the attention it deserves, for sure. But this is one that seems to be especially undervalued, maybe compared to some of the others. So thank you very much, Quentin, for helping us out there. All right. Well, that is it, folks, for this week. Next week, I'm going to be talking to Alistair McLeod, and we're going to also have another exciting junior exploration company to reveal to you. So until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.